So here in Psalm 22, let's go ahead and start reading here in verse 1. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Far from my deliverance are the words of my groaning. My God, I cry by day, but thou dost not answer, and by night, but I have no rest. Yet thou art holy, O thou who art enthroned upon the praises of Israel. In thee our fathers trusted. They trusted, and thou didst deliver them. To thee they cried out, and were delivered. In thee they trusted, and were not disappointed. So you can tell right from verse 1 of Psalm 22 that this is a messianic prophecy. And what gives you that indication? Why? What is so memorable or noticeable about Psalm 22 and verse 1? Yeah, Jesus said that very phrase. Jesus quoted this psalm in Matthew chapter 27 and verse 46. As he's hanging from the cross, he looks at the people who are looking at him, and he says this very phrase, my God, why have you forsaken me? Interesting phrase, isn't it? And I think it's worth a great deal of our discussion time to talk about the meaning of this phrase and its underlying character, and even some of the misconceptions that have arisen because of this phrase. So let's kind of just dive in there with just that first thought here in verse 1. The idea of God forsaking the writer of Psalm 22 and Jesus on the cross. Let's start with the writer of Psalm 22. Why would the writer of Psalm 22, a man who is clearly in the midst of a great deal of suffering, who's experiencing immense trials and pain every day at the hands of his enemies, why would this be the introductory remarks of a man writing Psalm 22? We would presume to be David. What does this introduction serve? Lance has a comment.
It communicates a very low point in whoever is saying this life.
That's a good point. I like that. It communicates a very low point. Start the psalm on a low point. If you've read Psalm 22, I'm going to ruin the ending for you. Does Psalm 22 end on a very high note? Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I think it's a good piece of literature here. We were joking about being an English major here right before class started. But this is a nice piece of literature. If you just look at it, just kind of in those terms, you start at the lowest of the low, my God, why have you forsaken me? There's a sense of abandonment, a sense of being left behind or being left out. And it's a question also. It's not just a statement of fact. It's a, why have you done this? We're not questioning the fact of the being forsaken. We're questioning the why behind it. Why have you forsaken me? I'm low. I'm broken. I'm left out. I'm excluded. And this is an immense piece of pain that he's talking about here. This is a great piece of literature, though, in that description. That's a good point. I like that. Bring him very, very low. Here's something that verse 1 is not saying, okay? In our misunderstandings of my God, why have you forsaken me? This is what Psalm 22 verse 1 is not saying. He's not saying that he doesn't believe in God anymore. You get that? So many times the default when we're going through times of suffering is to go, well, that's it. That's enough of God. That's enough of religion for me. I don't want to believe in a God who would allow these things to happen. I don't want to believe in a God who would let me suffer like this. I don't want to believe in a God who would allow such injustice in the world. And that's kind of like our culture's default response to human suffering. And yet, he's not saying he doesn't believe in God. Okay, and that's just something that the verse is not saying. He's not saying, well, I'm going through all this trial. That's enough of God in my life. You know what it is saying? It is saying that I still want to have something to do with God. The very fact that he's asking the question, the very fact that he's not going around God's back or going behind God's back, shows he still wants to have a relationship with God. The very fact that he's asking God the question means he's reaching out to God. Brian, go ahead.
Well, it's like the second part of that verse. Why are you so far away from helping me? Why are you so far away from hearing the words of my groaning? So it's not, I don't believe in you anymore. It's, I know you're there. Where are you? And why are you not right here with me while I'm going through this?
And Rick has a comment also here. And can we ask that question with an honest heart and still stand justified before God? I think that's a really, really key point there is it okay to ask God the tough questions? Or is God too scared of tough questions? Can you ask God, well, what about children starving to death in Africa? And God gets all sheepish and like, ooh, I didn't think they were going to ask me about that one. Well, what about hurricanes? What about injustice in the Middle East? Ooh, I didn't think they were going to ask that one, Jesus. Is God scared of tough questions? No, I think you can ask these questions with the right heart, with the right motive, and still stand justified. And I think David's a perfect example of it. He's a man who says, God, I don't get it. Why are you doing this? Why are you so far from me? Why are you not listening to me? And yet he still stands before God. It's not a man who doubts God, not a man who doesn't believe in God, not a man who has rejected God, but is one who simply wants to know the answer to life's tough questions. Go ahead, Rick.
I was going to say, you know, Jesus had taught that he and the Father were one. And now, you know, the idea here is the sense that that oneness is not there at this moment. And he is all by himself, taking on the sins of the world. I can't comprehend the emotion, the feeling that went with that, but I hope we can appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a good point also, which kind of goes, you know, that translates from the writer of a psalm to Jesus who quotes the psalm. Does Jesus stand before God justified even though he asks the question? That's something people assume. They assume so much, and I don't like it when folks will look at that in Matthew, say, well, Jesus had a moment of doubt. Jesus had a moment of weakness. Oh, that was the one sin Jesus committed, or that was God, Jesus resenting the Father for rejecting him, or forsaking him, or casting him off. I guess I just don't buy that can you ask the question and still be justified? Yes, I think you can. If it's an honest question, asked with an honest heart, with the right motives, and you just want to know. It's not from doubt, it's not from anger, it's not from bitterness. It's just wanting to know the answer. Where are you right now? I don't doubt you, God. I just want to know where we stand right now and what I'm supposed to be doing in response. Go ahead, Mike.
I think David wrote Psalm 22, and I think David wrote Psalm 3. Mm-hmm. Psalm 3 starts out, Lord, how they have increased who trouble me. Many are they who rise against me. Many are they who say to me, there is no help for him in God. Hmm. That's what David says in the third psalm, saying, look at me, I'm praying. On the radio program this morning, you talked about Elijah and Baal. Mm-hmm. Where's Baal?
Yeah.
Where's God? Men are looking at me and saying, where are you? You're not helping me.
Yeah.
But the third verse says, but you, O Lord, are my shield.
And I like that. That to trust God enough to say, I don't understand right now why I'm going through this. I don't get it. I don't find it to be very pleasant. And yet in the long run, I know and I trust that God has my back. In the long run. That to see beyond just the immediate, to see just beyond what I'm experiencing right now. And say, this has got to be part of something bigger, a larger process at work in my life. Mitch, go ahead.
You know, it seems that, to me at least, the only solution to the dilemma of man's sins was Jesus, the perfect lamb, the perfect sacrifice dying on the cross. There's just no way around that, it appears. Mm-hmm. So that being said, Jesus hanging there, dying for worms like you and me, that there was no way out. I mean, he had to do it, and in a sense, God let him do it. I mean, he wasn't going to rescue him. So in a sense, he was being, so to speak, I'm using quote, abandoned for that length of time because that he had to pay that for you and me. At least that seems that way to me.
Yeah. Yeah, and that we're going to get, I want to get into that here in just a minute once Dale has an opportunity to talk, but I think we need to ask more questions about why Jesus quotes Psalm 22 in the first place. And I think we're going to have a good couple comments on that one as well. Go ahead, Dale.
Yeah, and I'm not sure he's necessarily questioning why he's in this position and why God's in his position. It looks to me like he recognizes that he's the one at fault here. Mm-hmm. It's not what have you done to me?
Yeah.
It's I've done something here. I mean, he says in verse 6, I'm a worm and I'm not a man and a reproach of men and they sneer at me, acknowledging that he's got an issue. Now, if this is David, that would make sense. And if it's Jesus, he's been made that on our behalf. Mm. So it's not necessarily questioning God, why have you done this to me? I think it's I'm in this position. I need you to rescue me.
Yeah.
And not that God's not going to, but at this particular moment, he feels isolated.
Yeah, that's a good point. And so let's connect it now to Jesus on the cross. Okay? Let's connect it there. There's more going on with Jesus on the cross than just Jesus going, oh God, you abandoned me. Woe is me. I feel so sad right now. There's more going on there. You have to wonder, what's the purpose of the question? Why is he asking the question? Is it for his sake, or is it for the sake of the people who are listening? There's more than one reason to ask, why have you forsaken me? It could be less so, and this is my take on Jesus on the cross. I think it's less so about Jesus saying, woe is me, I've been forsaken, why? And more about Jesus looking at the crowd and going, why have I been forsaken? Hey, you know the answer, don't you? We talk that way too, don't we? We ask rhetorical questions of that nature all the time. We say to our kids all the time, why do I put up with you every day? Because I love you. Right? They knew the answer. And I'm not saying, why do I put up with you every day? I'm so annoyed. No, we say, why do I put up with you every day? Why do I allow this to happen? Why did I discipline you? We ask the rhetorical question because we know our kids already know the answer. Why do I put up with you? Why do I tolerate this? Because I love you and I think you're worth it. And so here's Jesus saying, why has God forsaken me? God has forsaken me for you. God has forsaken me on your behalf. Go ahead, Brian.
I was just going to say the passage that always ties this together is, for me, is Isaiah 53:10. Mm-hmm. Yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him. He has put him to grief. When you make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed, and he shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. It was God's pleasure to do that, not in the act itself, not in hanging Jesus to the cross itself, not in that pain that he had to go through, but what it brought about, like Mitch was saying, it was the salvation of each and every one of us. That was what God was looking for, was our salvation in that act. And so that's why it was not only necessary, but it pleased God to put him into that position. And it just seems like such a challenging thought, but I mean, that's the love of God right there.
And it's so easy. The Bible skeptic will look at Jesus on the cross and say, moment of weakness. Moment of weakness right there. Boy, Jesus really didn't have a whole lot of fortitude there in what was supposed to be the climax of his life. That's not a lot of fortitude for a guy like Jesus. That's what the skeptic sees. The skeptic sees the question is looking inward. The Christian, I think, takes it to see the question is looking outward. And I love that you brought in Isaiah 53, by the way, Brian. That was a good quote. Go ahead, David.
I think what we see here is, as common among us, many people would say, Hebrews 11. Mm-hmm. And we're supposed to understand what they're talking about. And Jesus started quoting this scripture to people who should have known this scripture well and recognized that he is who he says he is.
That is a great, great thought. And that's actually the next place I wanted to go was, did Jesus expect a little bit more from his listeners that day on the cross than just hearing one sentence from Psalm 22? Understand that it was a typical teaching method among the Hebrews to quote isolated scriptures with the expectation that you go home and read the whole context. That's why when you look at 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, the book of Romans, okay, when you read what Paul wrote, because of space on the page, because he didn't want to quote whole chapters, Paul would give snippets in his quotations. You know, Paul and the other apostles quoted the Old Testament in much smaller snippets than we typically would quote the Bible from a sermon, from the pulpit. And it's not because they didn't care, and it's not because they didn't have a text available to them, and it's not because that was all that from the verse they could use. It was just typical in Hebrew teaching from the synagogue to quote snippets of a passage with this kind of unspoken expectation that you know I'm referring to the whole thing. If I quote one verse from Isaiah 53 to you, you're supposed to open up your mind to see, oh, he's talking about all of Isaiah 53. If I quote one verse from Psalm 22, it opens it up and I say, okay, he's talking about Psalm 22. Even though I quoted one verse, the expectation is that you open up the whole chapter and look at the context. Barry Kirchhoff uses a term, and I've always really liked it, suitcase terms. They're terms that seem to be very compact and small, but then when you open them up like a suitcase, there's more inside. You start unfolding things and you realize there's a whole wardrobe in here. And that's what Jesus is doing with Psalm 22. You hit the nail on the head there with that comment, David. That's what Jesus is doing. He's quoting one verse from Psalm 22, but inherent in that quotation is this statement of, okay, go home and read Psalm 22 now. You just finished crucifying me. When you get home, pull out Psalm 22 and read it, and you're going to kick yourselves hard from what you find in that psalm. It's go home, open up the suitcase, and start taking Psalm 22 out, and you'll go, whoa, did we just do Psalm 22 to this guy? That's exactly, I think it's a really good point that you make. That's a good point. We do the same thing too. You know, we might quote one small isolated part with the expectation that we kind of understand the broader context. Context, context, context. Go home and read Psalm 22. You get one verse. Go home and read the rest of the chapter and you're going to be pretty shocked by what you find, I think. Go ahead, Lance.
Well, there, I don't know what indexing system they had other than to quote a well-known passage from the reference in a book. And obviously the Psalms, I don't even know if they were numbered in the original
organization. They might have been in a sense, because at one point Paul does quote, he says, from the second Psalm he quoted. So you know, there was a sense there.
But they were Isaiah was one scroll.
Yeah.
And there, if you wanted to reference a part in Isaiah, you referenced a well-known passage from Isaiah.
Yeah.
And so that led took you to the context. Yeah.
We would say Isaiah 53, whereas they might start it off by quoting something from Isaiah 53. And everyone will go, okay, that's the context. That's the part of Isaiah that's talking about the man of sorrows. They wouldn't know it as Isaiah 53, but they would know it as the passage about the man of sorrows. We might look at Psalm 22 and go, oh, he's quoting from Psalm 22, verse 1, which is a numbering system that didn't exist in that time period. But by saying, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? They go, oh, that's the psalm about my God, why hast thou forsaken me? That's the psalm about the man who's suffering. We could do it in the number of others. You know, we might quote Psalm 23. They might say, the Lord is my shepherd. And everyone would go, oh, yeah, that's the psalm about the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Yeah,
and that's a good point. They knew these psalms, like, we know these hymns. Mm-hmm. Right? So if you say that, it's like, oh, that psalm.
Yeah.
That psalm.
Yeah. We wouldn't say, you know, song number, what's song number 47? Is God Is So Good? We would not say, let's sing song 47. We just say, let's sing God Is So Good. We don't need to know the number anymore. We just know it as God Is So Good. Or if I said, let's sing Soldiers of Christ Arise. I'm not going to call out, was it 231, I think, is Soldiers of Christ Arise? I'm not going to say, let's sing number 231. You're going to go, you have to pull out your songbook and figure out which one is number 231. You're all going to test me on it. Now I'm going to start hearing songbooks from... You're going to, you know the sound that songbooks make? Brian, did you have a thought?
Unless you're Austin. Austin knows all
oh,
the songs.
Oh, Austin, did you have a thought?
No.
Oh, Austin just knows every song? Yeah. Well, that's the kind of brain that you have, Austin. Everybody has a talent. You know, that's a good one. All right, so I think we've done a really good job with that. But let's ask a quick question then. With all that being said, that Jesus expected them to know Psalm 22. That was a passage they should have already known. And if they didn't know it, they could go find the scroll and look it up. With all that being said, if they knew Psalm 22, why were they so unaware of the fact that they were in the process of fulfilling Psalm 22? What and that's the discussion question here on the second page of our notes. If it was so apparent based on this psalm that they were actually fulfilling a prophecy, why didn't they recognize it at the time? What factors could have contributed to their blind hatred of Jesus? Because I'll tell you what, if I was in the process of fulfilling a psalm and I could go, whoa, I'm fulfilling a prophecy here, that's like, that's just talking about me right off the page. I suppose, I don't know. I don't think I can stand in judgment of them. I might have been just as blinded as them. But maybe what factors contributed to their blindness to the truth of Psalm 22 and the prophecy?
Prejudice.
Yeah, that's a good one. David, go ahead.
They never thought he was the Messiah. And they never thought he was a king. So that Psalm 22 just wouldn't come in their mind at all.
And you know, and it makes me wonder, would they have even thought that Psalm 22 was a messianic prophecy in the first place? Why would their Messiah king suffer like this man in Psalm 22? Why, if their expectation was for a literal king to come and rule on the throne in Jerusalem, for him to be highly exalted, to lead Israel back into glory in the promised land, Psalm 22 sure doesn't fit that preconceived idea of the Messiah. They might not have even had any sense of Psalm 22 being messianic in nature at all. Now, I can't jump in their minds. I can't be in their brains and know what they were thinking at the time. But Psalm 22 certainly seems incongruous with maybe some of those preconceived ideas about the Messiah. I think that's a really good point. Rick, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it defies man's logic.
It defies man's logic. Yeah, it defies man's logic. This doesn't seem messianic. Now, we have the benefit of hindsight. We have to acknowledge that. I'm glad we do. I would not trade my position in human history for their position in human history. We have a great benefit, and that's hindsight. We can look back and go, well, I tell you what, you read the book of Matthew and Mark and Luke and John, and then you read Psalm 22 and Isaiah 53, and it's pretty hard to ignore that pretty much every single little tiny detail in this psalm was fulfilled precisely in the death of Jesus Christ on the cross. Mike?
I'm going to go with what both men have said already. And then over in Luke chapter 3, or chapter 4, when Jesus gets up to read in the synagogue, mm-hmm. and he sits down.
Yeah.
And they're astonished. And he says, now this verse has been prophesied for you this day, and I've fulfilled it. Mm-hmm. And what did they do? Take him out to a cliff and throw him off.
They wanted to throw him from a
prejudiced.
Cliff. Yeah.
You're not above the law. Who are you? You're Joseph's carpenter's son.
Mm-hmm.
So now he's on the cross quoting a verse of their beloved King David. Who are you to quote David?
Is it easier to dismiss Jesus on a cross? Yep. Oh, he's dead. That guy's going to be dead in about 6 hours. He'll be out of our hair. We're done. We dealt with the Jesus problem. That whole Nazarene thing, boy, They were wiping the sweat from their brows going, glad we wrapped that thing up nice and tidy, got him on a cross and finished this whole thing, stuck him in a tomb and even put guards in front of it. Whew, boy, good thing we don't have to deal with that whole Jesus character anymore. Right?
Well, I think the, you know, for us today, maybe something that we can relate to with them is sort of the mob mentality or the... Mm-hmm. sort of the rage factor, I guess. Like if you've ever been in a situation where you're just heated and super angry about something, like even the most wise and calm and thoughtful advice to you is just totally not something you want to consider at all. Hmm. And so You know, even in this moment where Jesus is saying probably one of the most sane and logical things to them, trying to get them to go back into your mind, you know, reason and logic, you know, appealing to their logic, you know, somebody who's angry and somebody who's just caught up in the emotion of that time is probably not even going to consider what he's saying at all.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. Just hatred blinds us, you know, to all kinds of things. That was true of the scribes and the Pharisees and the chief priests. It's true of us today. It's true of a lot of the same people who only a week earlier were throwing palm branches and jackets down on the road going, "Hosanna to the Son of David in the highest." And then less than a week later, some of those same people were gathered around Pontius Pilate's abode saying, "Crucify, crucify." Let's keep going here. Let's look at verses 6 through 8 real quick. "But I am a worm, a reproach of men, and not even a man, despised by the people. All who see me sneer at me. They separate with the lip. They wag the head, saying, 'Commit yourself to the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, because he delights in him.'" I mean, it's eerie the way that this was fulfilled, wasn't it? It's eerie to go in and read. And there's a number of scriptures in your notes, of course, in Luke chapter 23, verses 32 through 39, Mark chapter 15, 27 through 32. It's eerie to see the way that they wagged the head, they sneered at him, they spit upon him. And they said almost these exact words of, "Hey, he said he was going to tear the temple down in 3 days. Hey, he said he was going to do all this. He said he was the Son of God. He said he was that. Well, he can't even save himself from a cross. You who were going to save everybody else, well, just save yourself from the cross now, buddy." It's eerie the way that these verses were fulfilled so precisely, just as Psalm 22 predicted. The people of his day mocked the Lord, hurled insults at him, and took his own words and insulted him sarcastically by his own words. You know, so on the one hand, I think the writer of Psalm 22, David, actually sees himself as a worm, and that's people who've been brought low by sin. When you're brought low by sin, we all know, every one of us in this room knows what it's like to commit a sin. We know what it's like to feel like garbage. When you've done something and you feel like just garbage, you feel like you're a worm. I think from Jesus' perspective, it's not that Jesus felt like he was a worm in moral terms. I think maybe from Jesus' perspective, he's saying, "I'm being treated like a worm. I'm being treated like a worm and not a man." You know, capital criminals are about as low on the social totem pole as they get, don't they? I mean, I can't think of anything else that's lower in terms of regard and social status as a capital criminal. Someone sitting on death row. Okay, pedophiles maybe. Yeah, then maybe that's one. Pedophiles. Politicians. It was just dangling out there, just right there. Go ahead, Dale.
Yeah, one of the things that this clearly shows is Jesus is looking at this event not from his godly side, but from his man side.
Yeah.
So, and that gives us a lot more comfort. If we all we ever saw of Jesus was he as they reproached him, he just said, "I'm God, you can't hurt me. Mm-hmm. I'm God, I'm not upset by this. I will rise again. I'm not worried about any of this." That wouldn't have given us a whole lot of comfort to see that side of it.
Yeah.
When we see this side of it and he says, "What people said to me mattered, what they did to me made a difference. I saw this whole event and experienced it as a man, not as someone who couldn't be touched by all of the human emotion." And so in this, he's giving us that side of it instead of the side where God, the great and powerful, would have experienced it.
That's a really good comment. That really touched me, actually. Bravado would not have impressed anybody. Jesus, did he have access to immense miraculous capabilities? Could he have knocked the temple over and rebuilt it miraculously? Sure. Could he have decimated the entire city of Jerusalem? Sure. Could he have appeared to them as a giant 600-foot-tall beast? Of course he could have. Bravado would not have impressed anybody, though. What impresses us what impresses us is the emotional investment that he had in them. That really touches me to think about the way you said it, Dale, really got me, that he cares what people thought of him. Does it hurt the person of Psalm 22 that people treat him like this? Does he take it personally? Is he hurt? Is he broken by it? Is he emotionally suspended because of the way people treat him? Hurting Jesus' body is one thing, and the destruction of the earthly body was necessary. He needed to die on a cross, physically, literally, carnally, needed to die on a cross to be a sacrifice for our sins. I'm not devaluing or dismissing that at all. But to kind of put yourself in Jesus' shoes, what do you think hurt more? Having nails driven through your hands and your feet? Being tortured to death? Or what hurt more? Seeing the people he cared about and that he loved as a mother hen loves her chicks, like he says in Matthew chapter 23. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how I longed to gather you under my wings. What hurt him more, having nails driven through his hands, or seeing the very people he came to save reject him and insult him, mock him, and mocking God in front of him? The very mission that he came to accomplish was being derided. That, to me, that's the emotional stake right there. Jason?
Well, and to amplify, not only is he suffering all this anguish from how he's being treated, he is also in a position where he's never been, where he's separated from God. Hmm. There's a spiritual anguish there that we can never understand, because he is one with God. But this is a period of time where he's carrying all of our sins on him, and he has a void between him and God that he is possibly never, probably never known.
Yeah.
And that the anguish and pain of that probably is beyond anything that we could ever comprehend. And he's separated from God. And not only that, is he being treated the way he is, he's separated from, I am a worm.
Jesus did not go to his death as some kind of stone cold, calloused person. Like, he was not going like, bring it on, bring it on. He was a man who spent the night before his crucifixion crying and praying. I mean, crying and praying is not the same as like, all right, whatever, I can handle it. You bring it on, right? He was not calloused in this. It was a jarring experience for him to be thrust the way that he was into physical pain and death and the spiritual separation and the burden and the weight of the sin. That was a novel, never before experienced, jarring, painful time for him that cut him all the way to his divine emotions. It's a good way that you put that. Let's keep reading here. Verses 9 and 10. Yet thou art he who didst bring me forth from the womb. Thou didst make me trust when upon my mother's breasts. Upon thee I was cast from birth. Thou hast been my God from my mother's womb. I think that's really important to see that the devotion was there always. That God was devoted to him and that he was devoted to God. Now, we can only speculate about what Jesus was like in all the time as a child and a young man. We're given little glimpses in the Gospels, but that's all they are, is mere glimpses. And yet, I think this is a great verse that affirms a couple things that are slightly tangential, I suppose. But it affirms that Jesus spent his entire life devoted to God and that he did not have the Christ brought upon him at his baptism. That's a fallacy and a heresy that's existed for about 2,000 years, by the way. John the Apostle had to deal with it in his own time period, of folks who had this kind of idea that Jesus was a man, a normal guy, born of the flesh, and that the Christ was brought upon him by the Spirit at his baptism. And then just before his crucifixion, the Christ left Jesus the man, and Jesus the man died on a cross, physically. Total heresy. Total heresy. You've been my God from my mother's womb. I've been yours. You've been mine. There's a devotion there. There's a lifelong devotion. I am who I am, and I've always been that. And there's no kind of duality or anything that's going on there. Interesting couple of verses. Slightly tangential. I think verses 9 and 10, If just totally tangent, by the way, but if you're looking for just an extra Bible verse to put in your arsenal on the subject of abortion, I think verses 9 and 10 are an interesting couple verses there, that you've been my God from my mother's womb, that even in my mother's womb, from inside my mother's womb is what the language is there, you were still my God there. Even from the womb, you've been my God. From the womb until now, until the day I die, and when we're together for eternity, you've been my God. So, does God highly value the life that is in the mother's womb? Yes. Is that life a life that has a soul? Yeah. Maybe it does not have a life, an independent life that the skeptic or the humanist might define it, but it is a life that has a soul imbued with divine qualities, and that God loves that soul and takes care of that infant inside the womb. I just think that's, if you just want to have a little couple extra Bible verses there to log away, I think that's an interesting set of verses. Let's jump into verse 11, though, okay? Because this is where we start to get some really nitty-gritty stuff here. If you're not, and I'm not saying you are, I'm just asking rhetorically, if you're not convinced yet that Psalm 22 is a supremely detailed messianic prophecy, you're about to get your socks blown off here. Blown off or knocked off? I think it's get your socks knocked off. We're going to blow your socks off, though, by Psalm 22. Let's read here, okay? Verse 11. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, for there is none to help. Was Jesus alone? Rejected? Where were all of his disciples when he needed it most? They were asleep. Can't you even stay awake and pray with me for a few hours? Can't you even stay awake right now? Okay, well, after that, where were his disciples during his trial? Yep, they ran away. The only one who kind of showed up, John showed up and let Peter in the door, but even John and Peter kept at a distance, didn't they? Where was Peter? Warming his hands by the fire going, Jesus? Who's Jesus? Never met the guy. Hey, how do you guys like those chief priests, huh? In the moment when he was being tortured and crucified. Now, I'll give John some credit, okay? We have to acknowledge, John was at least within earshot, because Jesus does say to John, this is your mother now, take care of her. So, John was at least within earshot, but how involved John was, that it was not John who offered him water, it was not John who was kind of right next to him. John was at least within earshot. But even with that being said, this is still an incredibly lonely moment for him. There's none to help. There's no one here to defend me. There's no one here to stand up for me. There's no one here to rescue me. I'm on the cross. I'm dying. I'm gone. Interesting verse there. Verse 12. For many bulls have surrounded me. Strong bulls of Bashan have encircled me. Some think that the bull could be kind of a symbol for Rome. And that would have been typical. That would actually have been typical in Roman literature, in Roman poetry. The bull is often seen as a symbol of Rome. They use the eagle as well, but they would often be symbolized as a bull, even in their own poetry. Why? Strong, big, muscular, powerful. You don't mess with the bull unless you want to get the horns. They open wide their mouth at me as a ravening and a roaring lion. I'm poured out like water. All my bones. What does that mean? I'm poured out like water. What came out of Jesus' side when he was pierced with that spear? Water mixed with blood. I'm poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint. What kind of process would have been involved in getting him actually on the cross? You have to understand, there's not a, and we're going to get gruesome here. You have to understand, there's not a lot of wood in Judea. Not a lot of wood in this part of the world. So wood was very valuable. They would reuse the cross over and over and over again. They would actually leave the upright part of the cross in the ground. Kind of stuck in the ground, it would just stay there. That was the crucifying area. That was Golgotha, place of the skull. Got the cross up there. But the cross beams, they'd reuse the cross beams. And they just kind of, one size fits all. And if your arms weren't quite long enough to get to the holes, because this beam, you have to understand, This thick beam had holes where those stakes would go and where those nails would go. If your hands couldn't quite reach the holes on the sides, what they would do is they'd tie your hands to horses, unhinge your arms so that you could fit the crossbeam. All my bones are out of joint, even if they weren't out of joint as a result of being stretched to fit the cross, if you think hour after hour after hour of hanging there like this, lifting yourself up for every aching breath, you think at some point you're going to kind of lose stability in your joints. All of my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It's melted within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd. Have you ever been to like Native American camps? Monuments to Native American camps or cities. It's really interesting how you can go to a lot of these places and they still have potsherds all spread out all over the ground. What do you think of when you think of a potsherd? What's that? Yeah. I think of dry. You know, they're just dry. You know, it's just dust. Just dusty, dry, nothing. That's what his tongue felt like. That's why Jesus asks for something to drink, because his tongue is dry. How long had it been since Jesus had had something to drink? I can't say 100% for sure, but I highly doubt that he had anything to eat or drink during the night where he was praying. So conceivably, it was the night before when he was instituting the Lord's Supper. So, I mean, it could have been, what? Quite a long time, longer than we were probably used to. Hours and hours and hours. My tongue cleaves to my jaws in verse 15. And thou dost lay me in the dust of death. They would have to lay a person down to get that cross on them. You know, they'd put the cross on the ground and they'd lay you down on it, stretch out your arms so that you could reach the holes for the stakes to go in through. So you'd have to be laying down first, and then they would get a rope and tie it to there, and they'd crank you up over the cross and get you connected to the upright beam. So they lay me on the ground in the dust of death, for dogs have surrounded me, a band of evil. What did Jesus call Gentiles? And I know this is kind of tangential, but do you remember when the Gentile woman came to him wanting to be healed? Remember that really interesting exchange that they had where this woman shows incredible insight and he says, it's not right. It's not right for me to feed the dogs. And what does she say? Even the dogs get the crumbs. Now, Jesus is not being, he's not being a racist, okay? It's not racism against Gentiles. But the fact that Jesus uses the dog to represent the Gentile, and here you have dogs have surrounded me, what kind of soldiers were surrounding him on the cross? Roman soldiers, Gentiles. Gentile soldiers surrounded him. And Jesus even uses the terminology of Gentiles and dogs. So that might be a stretch. I don't want to stretch it too far or anything, but I think there's some merit there to seeing that same language there. A band of evildoers has encompassed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. Like, and you're going, at this point, you're going, whoever denies Psalm 22, whoever does not see Jesus here, whoever can read the death of Jesus, compare it to Psalm 22 and Isaiah 53 and others, and walk away unimpressed, you don't get it. You don't get it. It's almost 1,000 years difference between David and Jesus. You ever think about that? Here's David writing Psalm 22, and 1,000 years later, an event that was physically out of Jesus' power. It's not like Jesus was orchestrating the whole thing, going on, okay, and now over here, I need you guys to cast lots for my clothes, and wine-filled sponge man, I need the sponge. He's not orchestrating this whole thing. He's not directing this whole thing. This is what's happening to him out of his own power. And you can read Psalm 22 and go, this is striking. They pierced my hands and my feet. Brian.
I think that's like one of the most compelling things about prophecy. Mm-hmm. You know, it'd be one thing if it was just Jesus there with, you know, a list of all the things he needed to fulfill and check them off one by one, and then he did all the things he needed to do. But the prophecies contained the detractors, the sort of the deniers of Jesus. Mm-hmm. It contained their actions as well. So
yeah.
Even though they would go on to deny who Jesus was and what, you know, their part in all of it, they were the ones actually fulfilling the prophecy as well.
Yeah.
So
that's,
you know,
interesting.
That's such an interesting thing that they'll go on the day of Pentecost and be able to look back and say, oh yeah, you know, that's what we did. And yeah. And those prophecies had to do with us too, not just Jesus.
Yeah, well, and Peter's preaching, Acts chapter 2, they would have had the benefit of some hindsight. It had been 50 days since this event, and after about 50 days, some of these people probably went home and and thought on this, meditated, had a little bit of a reflection now. Boy, that whole Jesus of Nazareth dying on that cross, that did sit well with me. That was quite a stirring thing. Made me think of Psalm 22, made me think of Isaiah 53, made me think of some other things. You know, they had 50 days to reflect on this, and then Peter shows up on the day of Pentecost and says, you did it! You killed him! You approved of it. You sat by and watched it happen. And the prophets have all predicted it. That's Acts chapter 3. He goes on to preach there in Acts chapter 3 after the healing of the lame man at the temple. The prophets all predicted it. They all looked forward to this day. Go back and read the prophets and you'll know it to be true. Mitch?
You know, the Jews had 50 days to reflect on it. The Jews of today have had 2,000 years to reflect on it.
Yeah.
What do they do when they get to Psalms 22? Because, you know, they're big believers, obviously, in the Old Testament and the Psalms. There's no way to explain this away. Do they avoid? I don't know the answer. Do they avoid Psalms 22? Because
conspiracy theories.
No. I have
no idea. But I can't. There's not a conspiracy theory. I mean, even if you were to say, even if the ultimate skeptic was to say, well, Psalm 22 must have been altered at some point after the fact, well, that can't possibly be true. That can't possibly be true. Because the very fact that Jesus quotes Psalm 22 on the cross means that Psalm 22 already existed when he was dying on the cross. That psalm was already there. They didn't make up Psalm 22. There wasn't some Christian in the 3rd century going, I'm going to fabricate some prophecy. I'm going to call it Psalm 22, and it's going to be about Jesus, and they'll never know. No. Because when Jesus is quoting Psalm 22, Psalm 22 already existed. Powerful evidence. It's powerful evidence. So they pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. I love that one. That's a great one there. It might be tempting to glaze over, kind of pass over that one. What do you think is going on there when he says, I can count all my bones? Of all the things that were hurt on Jesus' body, his joints pierced in the side, hands pierced, crown of thorns, lungs collapsing, being lashed and beaten and whipped on the back. Of all the things that happened to his body, what was kind of the one part of his body that was left alone? His bones. When they came to see if those guys were dead yet, they wanted to speed along the process. And if you had a guy on a cross who was lingering a little bit too long, because you had a little platform there by your feet. They would build a little platform, you know, about that big or so, where you could put your heels and you could actually hoist yourself up and catch a breath before you went back down. Because, you know, when you're hanging like this, it puts pressure on your lungs. You can't breathe. So you'd use that little platform and go like this and catch a breath and then sink back down. Because understand, the cross was not always a capital punishment. More often than not, actually, the majority of the times that people were crucified, it was just torture. They crucify you for a few hours and take you off of the cross. So they wanted to prolong human life somewhat. But when they were tired of dealing with it, what would they do? Break those legs so that you couldn't hoist yourself up anymore. And that would speed up the process. When they got to Jesus, we all know he was already dead and they did not break his legs. I can count all my bones. I think what he's saying is I can count every one of them is intact. I can take a head count here and say, okay, bones, how you doing? I can count all of my bones and they are intact. Really interesting little detail there. Dale?
When you look at him saying that he was poured out like water, when if you would look at him on the cross, everything would have flown from his hands back down to his feet. He would have just looked like he's been drawn down through his feet.
Melted,
And but if you look at, I mean, if you go work out for the first time in a long, long time, you'll come back and say, I can feel muscles I've never known I forgot I even had.
Yeah.
Well, he may be saying, every bone in my body hurts and I can feel every one of them.
Yeah,
because I'm just drawn down. This process has affected every bone in my body. While they may not have been broken, it would have been a stress on his entire frame.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a good way to look at it also. Yeah, and he would have had hours and hours and hours. What do you do with your mind for 6 hours on a cross? What do you think about? I mean, it's one thing, and I'm not devaluing this at all, you should know. It's one thing in the heat of the moment to jump on a grenade, all the adrenaline to jump on the grenade, and that's it. You know, no ramifications, life over, you did it, that's it. It's another thing to just dwell, to be hanging on a cross, to have hour after hour after hour, and we're not talking about 6 hours at Disneyland. Time is relative, isn't it? You know, we say, oh, time's not. Time is relative. There's a long 6 hours and a short 6 hours, and this was a long 6 hours. What do you think about? Maybe the only thing you have to think about to occupy your mind is to count your bones. Count how many bones hurt right now. To think about, maybe like you said, like after you work out at the gym and you go, I didn't even know I had a muscle there. Maybe Jesus is thinking about, I didn't even know my bones could hurt this bad. I didn't even know that bone was capable of hurting. It's a good thought, Dale. I like that. They look, they stare at me. Verse 18, they divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. And again, that's hard to deny, isn't it? Pretty hard to deny that they did this very thing. John chapter 19, verses 23 and 24 is where that's fulfilled, is they look at this one garment in particular and they go, well, we don't want to tear this apart. We'll divide up the other stuff, but let's not tear this piece. Let's go ahead and cast lots now for who gets to have the nice piece of fabric. It's amazing how, I mean, and again, like Brian pointed out, this isn't something that Jesus did. This isn't something he orchestrated here. He didn't direct this. This is something that relatively non-involved human beings standing on the sidelines are over there doing of their own volition, going, oh, this is a nice piece of fabric right here. Let's not tear this apart. Let's go and cast lots for this. Pretty heavy dose of evidence, isn't it? So, we've only got a couple minutes left here. Let's kind of bring things to a close now, because that's the brunt of the messianic portion of this prophecy. Not all of Psalm 22 is necessarily messianic, but I want to look at the conclusion to the psalm for a very, very encouraging, very, very optimistic lesson as he closes it. So not only is David in Psalm 22 experiencing a great deal of pain, but has so much confidence in God, Jesus is also experiencing pain, but has similar confidence to God. At the end of the road, what's waiting for Jesus? Resurrection from the dead and exaltation. That's what's waiting for him. Resurrection from the dead and exaltation. Glorification, to be at the right hand of God. It's as painful as it all was. Jesus must have seen this as that, like, this is the last mile of the marathon here. This is the home stretch. I get through this and I get to be done. At least with the painful part of it. I get through this, and it's back to God. It's back to glory. It's back to the existence that I'm meant to have at the right hand of my Father. I get through this, and this is the hardest part of it. This is the hardest part. Verse 25. Let's read 25 through the end of the chapter and notice a couple things here, okay? From thee comes my praise in the great assembly. I shall pay my vows before those who fear him. The afflicted shall eat and be satisfied. Those who seek him will praise the Lord. Let your hearts live forever. A little bit of Sermon on the Mount there. Huh? Those who hunger and thirst, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, because they will be satisfied. They'll eat and be satisfied, he said in verse 26. Verse 27, all the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord. That's Acts chapter 1, isn't it? You'll start in Jerusalem, and from there, you're going to spread out. That's the Great Commission, Matthew 28. You're going to go into all the remotest parts of the earth preaching the gospel to people. The whole world's going to know who Jesus Christ is. The whole world is going to hear the message of the gospel. All the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord. All the families of the nations will worship before thee. We're going to read on Wednesday night in Revelation chapter 21. All those people coming into that great city, the New Jerusalem. At the end of Revelation 21, it says they bring the glory of the nations into it. Revelation chapter 4, or chapter 5, excuse me, Revelation chapter 5, the song that they're singing, right? The song that they're singing. Every tribe and every nation and every tongue and every people are here singing now. All the families of the nations will worship before thee. For the kingdom is the Lord's, and he rules over the nations. That's Psalm 2. All the prosperous of the earth will eat and worship. All those who go down to the dust will bow before him. Even he who cannot keep his soul alive. Where's the power? Is the power in us to save our lives, or is the power with God? It's with God. And I love verse 30. Posterity will serve him. I think he's talking about Jesus there. Not the Father. I think posterity will serve Jesus. What's posterity? What does the word posterity mean?
Offspring.
It's kind of like the glory that you leave behind. You know, when you think of a posterity, George Washington was a man who left a posterity behind him. Even though George Washington didn't have any biological children, what kind of legacy does George Washington leave behind? What kind of legacy does Lewis and Clark leave behind? What kind of legacy, okay? What kind of legacy did Abraham Lincoln, what kind of legacy do you leave behind? There's a posterity. It's more than just your kids. It's about your legacy that you leave behind. And a legacy, a posterity will serve him. It will be told of the Lord to the coming generation. That's looking forward. This is prophetic right here. This is prophetic saying the coming generation is going to hear about the Lord. They'll come and will declare his righteousness to a people who will be born that he has performed it. Now, I know that a lot of people are born. But he says, to a people. Something kind of specific there, isn't it? Not to any people, but to a people who will be born. I think he's talking about Christ's own generation of people, believers in him, to a people who will be born. Are we the people who are born? Yeah, we're told of Jesus Christ, the coming of his kingdom and his glory, and I think we're that people. I think this is a great prophecy that is not just messianic, but it's also kingdom in nature. It's looking forward to the kingdom as it's going to be coming. Lance had a comment, I think, a minute ago. Have we passed by now? Okay.
I was just
going
to
ask it.
Go ahead.
I just reading this, thinking about Jesus being the first Adam, or the second Adam, and the new generation. And the posterity that comes from him, talking about spiritual things. And just thinking along those lines, didn't really have a comment, but just, is there something here about the Christians and the spiritual posterity that comes?
Oh, yeah. I do. And, maybe I'm putting in my hindsight, okay? It's easy for us from our hindsight to read the Old Testament and see Christianity all over the place. It's not necessarily everywhere. Not every passage, not every prophecy. I don't believe every prophecy is about Christ and the kingdom. I don't. I mean, there's prophecies that are specific. There's prophecies about this or that. So I think we need to be careful, and I want to caution myself as well as you. Don't just read Christianity into every little thing in the Old Testament, and yet, I don't know, when you read these last four or five verses of Psalm 22, it's really hard to avoid the conclusion that this language is looking forward to a fulfillment in the kingdom of Christ, and not just, leaving something sort of generic. And people, people will praise God for it. No, I think there is a people, a posterity, an offspring that's going to come that will hear of the Lord, that will hear of his good deeds, that will glorify him and will be a part of something bigger. So I agree with you. There's something in here. It might not be the most specific kingdom prophecy in the Old Testament, but there's definitely some overtones there. We'll go ahead and bring it to a close unless anybody has any concluding comments.